Hello, LabCast listeners. We hope you are safe and healthy wherever you are in the world right now. Before the world changed, we thought our spring 2020 season would consist of 5 episodes featuring incredible alumni working in music. However, like the rest of the university and the world, we've had to adapt and adjust those plans. This was no small thing. It means we're bringing you 2 episodes, and it means a lot of people came together to make those episodes possible, and we couldn't be more grateful to our NYU community of students, faculty, and administrators for that. The thing I'm personally most proud of is the resilience of the LabCast student team, who stepped up in unimaginable ways to ensure that we bring you at least a partial season. So thank you to our students who edit, co-host, and mix the show. You are incredible. There are 3 episodes that you will not hear this season, led by 2 student co-hosts, Tomoka Takahashi and Mary Walker, who are new to the family and are incredible, and also featuring guests like Joe Iconis, Cecilia Galt, and Matt Bond. We want to say thank you to Mary, Tomoka, and our guests. We will bring you those episodes next semester. Today, we invite you to enjoy our talk with Pulitzer Prize winner Michael R. Jackson, the composer and lyricist of A Strange Loop. Hello, LabCast listeners. Welcome back to our spring 2020 season. We're very excited. We're in a new space.
We are. This is the professional.
Right? We are in the Tisch building. Yeah. The 11th floor.
You're giving a lot of information, but
I guess. We'll be here
when they listen to this.
Sorry. Pretend you didn't hear that. We're in the Tisch building, which is new for us, and we're in like a fancy
sound image studio.
Yeah. Living for it.
We have all type of props and things.
And I mean, I feel like you already know who we are. I'm Ro.
I'm Jerusalem. And this is the LabCast. And this is season 3.
Yay. Who are we talking to?
Today, we are talking to someone I seriously wish I knew about before, Michael R. Jackson. As a self-identified playwright, composer, lyricist, and trash talker, the living Michael R. Jackson is also a NYU alum, having received his BFA and MFA in playwriting and musical theater writing from the Tisch School of the Arts. Since his time at NYU, Michael has gone from ushering at The Lion King and Mary Poppins to writing the book, music, and lyrics for his own amazing musicals, White Girl in Danger and A Strange Loop, the latter of which premiered at the Playwrights Horizon Theater in May of last year, 2019. He has received many an award, including being the 2017 Williamstown Theater Festival Playwright in Residence. And above all, I think Michael is a walking portrait of Black queer face conjuring up a big Black and queer-ass American Broadway, to quote his own musical back to him. So,
welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming. We're so excited. I'm a big musical theater nerd. I think you're a pretty big musical theater nerd.
We've gone over this.
And I loved your show. I loved A Strange Loop.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
So, I mean, I would just love to hear about your process. It was such a unique show and such a raw and vulnerable show. And so I'd love to know, like, how do you approach creating new work and that musical specifically?
It was, like, very much an accident, to be honest. Like, it started off, I was, as you mentioned in the intro, I was a student at NYU as an undergrad. I got to New York in 1999 to start the dramatic writing program. And I came to New York thinking I was going to be a soap opera writer. Like, that was what I had my heart set on doing.
Were you a soap opera fan?
I love.
Yes!
Which one? Deeply in my bones.
Which ones?
I grew up on Days of Our Lives and Another World. But then when Another World went off the air, I transitioned to One Life to Live and General Hospital. At a certain point, I was watching all of them. Like, because I would record on my little VCR. I know y'all don't know what that is.
But I know what a VCR is.
I would record my shows, and I would watch them after class and all
that
stuff.
My mom used to do that.
Yeah. But then I was studying playwriting, and I sort of fell in love with theater. And I, you know, my last semester or the last year, I don't remember which, I was, like, panicked about graduating, and I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And so I started writing this monologue called Why I Can't Get Work. And then I went to grad school about a year later, or like 9 months later. And then I got into the grad musical theater writing program at NYU. There, over the course of the year, sort of developed my voice as a lyricist. Mm. And then at the end of that first year, there was an assignment where a teacher said, if you're a words person who wants to try your hand at writing music, or a music person who wants to try writing words, go for it. And I had grown up playing piano. I'd sung in choirs. I was very musically inclined. And so I decided to try writing my own song, since I knew how to write lyrics. And so the song that came out of it was this song called Memory Song, which ended up in a strange loop. So I just kept writing songs on the side. And then eventually I started trying to put those songs with that monologue that I had written when I was an undergrad, because the monologue was very personal, because it was about like a young black man walking around New York sort of post-September 11, wondering why life was so terrible. And the songs were all very personal, and there seemed to be thematic overlap. And so once I started trying to put them together, it suggested something greater than the parts. After that, I called my friend Stephen Brackett, who had directed some concerts that I had done in between. He read the script and he was like, well, what if we did this with all black and queer people? And because that's not what it had originally been. Mm. And when he suggested that, it just made so much sense based on what the material was about. And so then we cast it that way and we did a reading in 2012. And it was like still a mess, but like there was something there. And then I put it away for like 2 more years. And then Shekinah Nafak approached me to say she was starting something called the Musical Theater Factory, which is going to be a development hub for new musicals. And she asked me if I had anything that I wanted to bring in to develop. And I said, well, I've had this musical that I've been sort of developing on and off for many years now. And so we brought it in. From there, she gave me a residency to actually do a reading of it. And that sort of was what started the momentum from that initial reading, because someone from Playwrights Horizons started tracking the piece to see when it felt it was ready to be shown to the artistic director. So then we did a reading of the show at Playwrights Horizons on November 11th, 2016. And that ended up being like very important, I think, because the mood in the room was like very, very dark. Because it was like 4 days after Trump had been elected, and just all these like white liberals were just like, the energy was just like palpable. And the reading just was like explosive. It was just like, it was just really good. And like, and I think people felt like very, like there was something real and theatrical and upset whatever the chemistry of that particular moment was in the room. Right. And it was a very powerful reading. And so about 9 months later, we did another industry reading. And then from there, Playwrights Horizons said that they were going to produce it in association with Page 73. And Barbara sort of helping behind the scenes. That's my amazing. Producer, Barbara. That time period was about 2001
wow.
to 2019 when the show went up.
Oh, my wow. God.
So we're talking about 18...
It was literally 18 year baby.
My baby. Like, I was like a very different person when I wrote that monologue. And by the time I was like a grown man, like when I like really wrote it, like really was working on it at Playwrights Horizons.
Well, I think that actually segues into the question I had for you, which you kind of answered, but I'd love to hear more about it. Were there ever any moments in your time as an undergrad or even in grad school where you said this is going to be a scene, if not in a strange loop, but just in writing in general?
Do you mean before I started writing the monologue?
Yeah, so just were there any moments for you as an artist and as a playwright that you experienced that you said, I have to write this down, like this needs to make it into something?
I mean, I'm the kind of writer that, I mean, everything is like potentially fodder. Mm. So like the thing about A Strange Loop that's interesting is that, because a lot of people ask me, oh, they call it autobiographical. And I say, no, it's not autobiographical. It's self-referential. Mm. Because I definitely drew from personal experience to write all of it. But I took a lot of things and I like made fiction out of it. Or like I made something else. So like there were things that like I, as like a young black gay man, you know, teenager, like dealing with my parents, that was the perspective that when I was 21 writing on it, I was really reflecting back on being like 16, 17. Mm. But then as I got older, I was then like still trying to capture that, but with more perspective on it as I got older. And so there were things like little moments maybe with my parents that I was like, oh, this thing happened, and I'm going to like use that as the source, and then I'm going to build on top of it into something that's appropriate for this character.
So you mentioned like reflecting back on moments with your family members, mm-hmm. and like
just growing up and like being like, I came of age, you know, as a gay boy, queer. I like vacillate between the two depending on what I'm talking about. But like as a gay boy, you know, in the mid to late 90s, and it was a very different political and cultural climate then. But the thing that was unusual was that I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, which is like a very black city. And I grew up, and like I came out at a time when there was, in my high school, there were so many other black gay boys, but like no one knew that except us. And like there was this, and I was in part of this all city choir, and that was filled with all these other black gay boys. And it was like this weird like community that was happening underneath the sort of the surface.
Right. Yeah.
And so it was, I always call it the black gay soap opera storyline, because it was just so much was going on.
Right.
There was all these people were hooking up and just like hooking up and breaking up and hooking up, and boyfriends were switching. It was just like, and then the lesbians were around all of this too. And then like one of them was my cousin, and then she was dating this girl, and then they broke up. It was just like stuff was just happening.
Right.
And then all of that sort of spilled over into then coming to New York, where it was like there was, I couldn't find anybody black and queer, really.
Mm.
And then that was when, like, whiteness took over.
Mm. Wow.
And then that, and so, like, I went through all these weird cycles of that. And all those things ended up informing the piece of, like, moving from one sort of hermetically sealed environment to a melting pot. You know, and like what that does to you sort of psychologically.
First of all, I'm from Chicago, which is another mm-hmm. very black city.
I went
city.
There for my seventh grade trip.
Yeah. We love that Detroit-Chicago exchange is something serious. I still have friends to this day who I met here that are from Detroit, and we mm-hmm. just instantly,
yep.
there was familiarity there. But I had a question actually about when, if at any time, did you find yourself at odds with other people that society or maybe your professors or whomever told you you should stick together with, right? So it's like this trope of black artists should stick together, but your politics are whack, or black queer artists should stick together, but, you know, maybe we just don't mesh as people. Like, has that ever happened in your experience?
So when I was in school, again, talking about it was, so like I talked about how like when I was in high school, it was a very different mm-hmm. environment. When I was in college, it was another totally different experience. Like environment than the way I sort of see a lot of young people and young artists and young artists of color dealing with now. When I was in school here in the drag writing department, nobody had said shit about black anything. Like mm-hmm. it was, you were just on your own. You just had to figure it out on your own. Like you literally, like, I remember going to Third North, which was the dorm that I lived in all 4 years I was in school. I remember, like, going into that dining hall, seeing the black people, and we all just, like,
converge. You converge.
You know?
Yes.
And so, like, those became, like, my closest friends outside of my department for, you know, which were my other friends as well. And some of them were in that department. But, like, we just had to find each other and figure ourselves out together. Nobody was like, you do... There was no one talked about identity. Hmm. No one talked about any of that stuff, unless it was like a student group you were in or you formed it yourself. I felt very often isolated and alone when I was in undergrad, because there was just no natural place for me to sort of gravitate toward, obviously, unless I just really sought it out.
Yeah.
And the internet wasn't as big of a thing then, so it wasn't like you could just go to a meetup or like go on Facebook and find your people very easily. Becoming an artist, a young artist, like there was no one to tell me like you should go this direction or that direction with your work. Like right. I really had to like figure it out on my own.
How did you figure that out? Because it's like voice is like so strong, so clear.
But that's, I mean, thank you, but that's from years of writing and rewriting and like thinking and like spending time alone and then like meeting people in the world changing. Like I had to really, I was like miserable for like a decade. Do you know what I mean?
Right,
or longer. And in that misery, I was fortunate enough that I also had my writing to turn to. Mm-hmm. So I was constantly, I was journaling, I was writing songs, writing lyrics, just writing thoughts. That was always what I had to turn to. If I didn't have that, I don't know what would have happened. I might have gone to a much darker place, because when you don't have an art form or something like that, and you have, and you're like isolated, like that can can send you to a dark place, I think. I wish I could say I had like a magic thing. I just kept doing it. But I had always been doing that. I've been writing since I was in middle school, you know, like in some form or another.
So the theme of like self-loathing comes up a lot in the musical. And you talked about sort of using writing as therapy, in a sense, mm-hmm. right? And getting you through
Therapy, or like just trying to figure out what was wrong. Mm. And the thing about the show that ties to my life in that way is that the thing that I had to realize was that nothing was actually wrong with me. Mm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so it was like I spent all these years, part of my writing was like, the subtext of all of it was like, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? I've been organizing my apartment. I've been working with an organizer to organize my apartment. And I keep all my journals. I have practically every journal I've ever written in since I was like 15 years old.
Oh my gosh.
And like, I was reading some of these journals to my organizer and cracking up, because half the time they would be like, my life is miserable. I'm such a piece of shit. What's wrong with me? I'm like, things that like when I read it out loud, it sounds absurd to me now.
Right, exactly.
But I remember being like 17, 21, 24, 26, 28, 30, just writing in my journals of like, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? And then like one day I like after going to therapy and like getting older and just things happening, I was like, oh, nothing's actually wrong with me.
Right.
And once you realize that, that's when you can like you can actually begin to grow.
Wow.
But that was my story. But I had to keep writing that question over and over and over again until the loop broke.
Right, right.
You know?
You just answered so many of the questions.
But I love it. It's absolutely phenomenal. I could hear you speak all day. Did you want to go into the... I want to hear about the Tyler Perry question.
Yeah, I was just about to ask that.
Where are our brains?
Yeah. Has Tyler Perry seen the show?
Tyler Perry has not seen the show. And as far as I know, he is completely blissfully unaware of it. I think he lives on his old plantation. And like, and he's like, doesn't know about me.
I mean... It is a plantation.
It is.
Formerly a plantation.
That's literally...
It was formerly a plantation. Yes, that was the whole...
Are you kidding me?
No. They said that like that meant something.
It was like built on a... Confederate
plantation. Yes. Like that. Yeah. That is where the Tyler Perry Studios is located.
But that's why he's proud of it, because he feels like he's taken something that was sort of evil and made this like big empire on top of it.
Yeah.
It's a very complicated time in blackness. That's something I actually think a lot about and thinking a lot about. It's a very complex time.
That's why I originally asked you that question about were you ever put together with people? Because it's interesting hearing as an NYU undergrad now who is in artistic things and artistic ventures is, if anything, now all they do is talk about identity before I talk about it. You know, it's like before I open my mouth, they're like, we know you as a black woman need resources. So here's this group that you should enter.
Yeah.
And then you're thrown together with people. It's not in the same way that you said there's no natural entry point unless you sought it out. Now I'm kind of inorganically being meshed with people based on identities that you don't even know if we really share.
Right.
You know?
And I think that's like the thing that particularly black artists, but even beyond that, are like, I think we're really in a moment of like, that's this weird bubble that we're in, because there's so much clamor for representation that like everyone is being erased.
Yeah.
And just sort of thrown together. And I'm for myself, because I've spent so many years going, what's wrong with me? Who am I? Whatever. Like, I've been dealing with identity for so long that to arrive at this moment when it's just like, I'm black, you're black, let's make a baby. I'm starting to push back against that because it flattens us out. And like, especially as artists, when what you're doing as an artist is trying to reveal and to show and to like get at something truthful, you know, something that might be an inconvenient truth. And if all and if everything is just like representation politics, then it, I think it's going to be harder to reveal that truth. Because also like, who is us? Like, I, the last 4 years since Trump was elected has been so eye-opening to me in talking to other Black people and to people in general. Because the thing I realized when Trump was elected is that you don't actually know who people are until you talk to them. Like, you just don't. But I found, like, I started, like, I had this, like, really interesting thing happen where the day Trump was elected, I, like, went for a long walk just to clear my head. And when I came back, I ran into one of my neighbors who is this Black dude who lives upstairs with his boyfriend, his white boyfriend. And I had been talking to both of them on and off throughout the primaries. And the Black dude was, like, a super anti-Hillary, like, in a major way. In a way that I understood, because there's people who are, like, I didn't want to vote for Hillary, but I voted for her. But, like, he was, like, no way. During the primary, he was, like, no way. He felt about Hillary the way that I feel about Bloomberg now. I won't vote for Bloomberg for nothing. And you can, you can hold a gun to my head and I won't vote for him. In the general, in the primary, I don't care. Anyway, but that's how he felt about Hillary. And I was like, oh, okay, well, whatever. And then I ran into him the day that Trump was elected, and we started talking, and I sort of glibly said, Happy New Year. And then he was, and then we started talking, and he revealed not that he had voted for Trump, he had voted for Jill Stein, but he was excited by the prospect of a Trump presidency because he felt like if Trump wasn't able to enact some of his immigration agenda, that would be beneficial for Black people because it would mean more jobs. And here's the thing. This is not an uncommon belief. This is a very conservative idea. But he, but that conservative idea is wrapped up in an ADOS, African Descendants of Slaves, identity, which is like a group. I hadn't heard of that group or that hashtag. So I started following that hashtag and listening to some of the things that people who very strongly identify as ADOS were saying. And then I kept having arguments with this neighbor, which then turned into like just regular conversations. And I realized, oh, there's some things we actually really agree on. And it's like now we're like friends. Even though we don't agree on a lot of stuff, but like we're friends. And but the thing I learned from talking to him and then starting, I started to follow a bunch of Black conservatives on Twitter and stuff. I was like, you know what? There's actually a whole lot of thoughts that are out here. And that a lot of these thoughts, if you look at the history of sort of Black politics and philosophy, these conversations are not new. They've been going on since the shackles came off. And so I've been, and I think all of that plays into this idea of the sort of these ideas of representation and just wanting to throw people together based on skin color, which is a form of racism that we're all trying to get away from. But we think that because there was once a time when there were people like me who felt isolated, that the answer to that is just go, well, you're Black, so y'all are just going to get along. But clearly, I run into my neighbor and we're like, we're on different, we have different thoughts.
How then does that for you and having these thoughts and seeing the and seeing this moment after 20 years, two decades of creating this piece in basically isolation, how has that changed, you know, your opinion of the musical theater landscape? Has it influenced, if at all, your artistic process now going forward to write new things?
So it's definitely impacted how I think about musical theater because while all of that gestating was happening and me figuring out sort of myself, and I was also figuring out my art and, like, the kind of art I wanted to be creating and assuming that I would never actually have a career out of it because I had been going to the theater that whole time and it was a very mostly white, mostly male landscape. And but then the thing that I noticed, this all goes back to, like, Trump being elected. Trump is elected, and then boom, what do I see in theater? Black, 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 black. Just like unprecedented number of Black playwrights being produced. And I started to ask myself, why is that? Is it because in this sort of hashtag resistance, Black artists are put on the front lines? That, like, with all this representation stuff, it becomes, like, convenient to, like, just program these Black artists, because that makes these white institutions feel like they're doing something. That's maybe, maybe not. Maybe I'm a conspiracy theorist. but I was part of that. And I was like, wait. And I luckily, my musical was at the end of last season. And so it gave me a lot of time to go and see things and to think about it and to think about how I wanted my contribution to this to be. And I changed my mind about a lot of that. Like, I came in, when I found out that my musical was being produced, I thought, this is going to be for us, by us, I'm going to make this blackity black, like, this is going to be the blackest black thing ever. But, like, the more I got into it, I was like, wait a minute. There's a lot of people who are going to come and see this musical because it's at Playwrights Horizons and because Page 73 is co-producing it. And not all those people are going to be black. And also, all the black people who do come and see it are not necessarily going to like it. And so I chose to really approach doing it as thinking that this is a story that everyone who comes to see it, I want everyone to meet it on their own terms. I didn't want to impose, I didn't want to put a frame on it that would, like, make people have to sit back. I wanted everyone to lean in and to experience it for what it was. And because it's gonna be black. It was all black. It was all black people on that stage telling black story. Like, that's just what it was. So I didn't need, if I could just feel confident in that, I don't need to, like, sell this other thing. And there's this term that I've, like, coined recently that I'm working on another piece about it. Identity marketing consulting. Because that's, like, what I call it. When, like, there's all these, like, sectors in the arts and in politics that everyone's, like, selling some idea identity of blackness and identity. Yeah. And black folks are doing it because it's lucrative. And, like, white institutions are making it lucrative. Mm-hmm. And, like, I didn't want to really participate in that. I wanted to tell a story that, like, was something very personal and hard, but also, like, uplifting in some way. And, like, I just wanted to tell the truth, like, just reveal, just, like, tell, like, that's, to me, theater should be a mirror, you know, to the truth.
I didn't see the show, but I watched the trailer, and your lyrics are very poignantly, like, black. Like, it was, his blackness doesn't look blue in any moonlight.
Right.
Or Tyler Perry, you have the line, is muscular black men who love the Lord and own businesses.
But that's, like, what it is.
Yeah. And
it's just what it is.
Yeah. And were you afraid the beehive was going to come for you?
I have all the disinfectant I need.
I would rather have this conversation off mic because okay, I really it, like the it way we are having. I like okay the rapport we have. And I don't want to start talking about Beyonce.
Okay.
We don't. No. Beyonce. I ain't nobody. Beyonce can buy and sell me.
I love it. No, this has been really.
This has been awesome.
This has been amazing. And then just in what we do here at the LabCast, and, you know, speaking to young artists, and this is ultimately being made for people like myself, right, who are in undergrad at NYU, really just trying to figure out artistically what it is we're doing. And it's great not only to be here, and I'm sure this episode will be amazing, but to experience this and to be able to see this. And, you know, you said it took you. It didn't take you, but this was a seed that was planted, you know, what is the equivalent of me now?
I mean, and to be clear, some people write musicals in, like, a year. Yeah. You know, it just, this particular one had, took the time that it took. Yeah.
But it's still affirming to both see and then just hear your process. And a lot of our, timeline is just similar, you know, even coming from Detroit or coming from a city like Chicago to a New York. Like, those are both major cities.
Right.
They have very different socioeconomic, very, very different racial, very different just societal, like, cultural setups and makeups that New York is pales in comparison. And sometimes it's just radically different. So it's really interesting hearing your process for a musical I have not seen yet. I feel like I have, or I feel like, oh, if I were to see this tomorrow, I would absolutely get it.
Well, if you'd like to see it, you can watch it at Lincoln Center on the archives, FYI.
Yes, I've been, that's a
been recommending
that's
people to who didn't get to see the project. It's a good recording. If you
but
want
with
to.
That being said, thank you so much
thank
for
you
joining us.
Yes, thank you
this
for having
was
me.
Amazing.
Where can people follow you
oh, yeah.
and hear your work?
If you want to follow me, I'm on Twitter at TheLivingMJ. I'm on Instagram at TheLivingMichaelJackson. And my website is TheLivingMichaelJackson.com.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thank you.
Yes.
That was kind of an amazing conversation. There were so many things. The one thing that stuck with me, because I think about this a lot, like the development process and just like how long it takes to make a thing.
Yeah.
And the fact that that took like 19 years to make. Feels about right, but also a little scary. But I think the takeaway is that, you know, it's important to have a few things, a few pots on the burner as a creative, and to make sure that you, like, don't give up on the good stuff, even if it takes a couple of decades to get it going. It's worth it because that musical is incredible.
Yeah.
It's, like, one of the best pieces of theater I saw last year.
I think, in relation to that, one of my big takeaways is that this is a very important time as someone who is, A, the age of the play itself. He started.
Don't ever say that again.
Michael wrote this, or I guess the monologue for it. I think it's something so beautiful about that because most often I find myself kind of disregarding this time in my life, you know? Oh, I'm just an undergrad. Oh, I'm still so young. Oh, like, on one hand, it feels like all of this matters and this is so poignant. And then on the other hand, it feels like none of this matters and this isn't my life yet. And wait till I'm in my 30s and I'm like the cool auntie who sends back money to my nieces and nephews. Like, it's a very, like, topsy-turvy just time. And so it's really, really affirming to hear from a creative who is brilliant and so funny to say that one of their greatest works came out of this moment of just confusion and turmoil. And so it was just super affirming to hear. And then also with him being a Black queer person who came through NYU.
A lot of queerness
myself,
in the room tonight.
A lot of queerness in the room tonight. and I, as a Black queer person myself, going through NYU, it was just very affirming to see. And then to also hear him say, I didn't think I was going to have a career out of this. And now he does.
Well.
And that was my takeaway.
What are you working on now? What do you want people to know about? What's exciting for you? Where can they follow you?
I am currently working on my first EP. And that is where I'm pouring a lot of my energy and heart into.
Send links.
It is, as I said, it's a work in progress. But you can follow me should you want to keep up at Killer, K-I-L-L-E-R, Gem, G-E-M, Jones, J-O-N-E-S. And my artist name is Jerusalem Truth, and I write poetry and songs and act and do the artistic things.
Awesome. Good to see you, Ms. Truth.
It was nice to see you too, Rev.
You're listening to LabCast, brought to you by the NYU Production Lab. Our editor is Jarek Bruall. Our in-studio recording was managed by Joey Carducci. This season of LabCast was produced in partnership with NYU Abu Dhabi and the Music Technology and Sound Recording Group. Head of production is Matteo Marciano. Assistant head of production, Rima L. Kayali and Toby Tinson. Sound engineers, Farah El-Mofawi, Aaron Marcus Willers, and B. Laszlo. Music by Abby T. Special thanks to the Tisch Department of Film and TV, Bruce Shackelford, Damian Panetz, and our guest, Michael R. Jackson. Shout out to John Tintori.